On this episode, best-selling author Trebi Johnson makes a return visit to talk about her newest book, Radical Joy for Hard Times, Finding Meaning and Making Beauty in Earth's Broken Places. I'm Richard Brendan, and you're listening to Dying to Live. Have you ever had that sick feeling when you see a clear-cut forest or mountaintop destroyed for mining? Do you grieve for the woods or the fields you played in as a child? You know, often we respond simply by abandoning these places as if they no longer count. Or else we work so feverishly to restore them to a state somewhere between what we remember and what we long for that we fail to pay attention to how they look and how they affect us. Well, in her new book, 7 years in the making, by the way, Trebi Johnson presents a passionate, pioneering new approach, choosing to respond to the loss of loved places in a way that opens us up to our sorrow and then express our gratitude with stories, mindful gazing, and spontaneous creativity offers a meaningful, vital, and even joyful path through the hard times we face on Earth. Trebi Johnson is a writer and, since 1993, a guide of vision quests, workshops, and other mythic journeys. In 2009, she founded Radical Joy for Hard Times, a nonprofit organization devoted to finding and making beauty in the Earth's wounded places, and currently serves as executive director. She's camped alone in the Arctic, studied classical Indian dance, written journalism about the Navajo and Hopi people, and slept in beautiful wilderness areas from her own backyard to the Sahara Desert. It was a joy to have her on several years ago. I have followed her work, and I'm thrilled to have her with us today. She's joining us from her home in the beautiful upper northeastern part of Pennsylvania. Trebi Johnson, it's such a joy to have you back on this program. It's been a while.
It's been a while, and when you called me, I was so pleased to hear from you because I remember that interview from my other book.
Yeah, well, I remember that interview, too, because you were a great guest. This book came out, we're talking about today, Radical Joy for Hard Times, I believe last year. I loved that title because not only was it appropriate last year, it's also the title of a foundation you've had for many years, probably even more appropriate, unfortunately, for our times now.
Yes, I think it is, unfortunately. And the title came to me just in a flash of inspiration. It was not the result of deliberate, conscious, long drawn out thought. And I like it too.
Yeah. You were quoted once as saying, even in the midst of suffering and grieving, people rally around one another, help where they can, open their arms and their homes to those who have lost even more. You know, there's some parallels here, not only in the title, but even in that quote and a few other things that I've read in the book, to some of the hospice work I've done with grieving and loss of loved ones. You're addressing the grieving and loss of really Mother Earth and what's been taking place environmentally.
Right. Yeah, and I even have, I quote a scientist in the book, a biologist working in Hawaii, who talked about his work as being hospice work for the Earth. And he was not meaning it in a positive way. You know, he went to Hawaii to study native species, and there are so many invasive species there, and he's very discouraged. But when I read that, I thought, well, hospice is a beautiful profession. You know, it's a beautiful calling, and people do very important work, and they sit by those who are failing and are not going to recover, and they sit with that as a reality. And so it seems to me that becoming hospice workers for the Earth could be a very beautiful thing, a very beautiful calling.
I like that phrase, actually. Not heard that before. I guess you just coined it, so I love that. I want to ask first, though, because we're going to be talking a little more in depth about this, but where did your love for nature come from?
I think I've always had it. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, I was born in Indianapolis, mm-hmm. where you do your program.
Yes.
And then I lived in Illinois. I lived in Omaha, Nebraska. And my backyards were my wilderness. Uh-huh. And I loved them. Mm-hmm. I grew up in an alcoholic family, so there mm-hmm. was a lot of chaos and upsets and shouting. And I just found that nature was where there was not only beauty, But there was also like a level of reality. Like you could, things died. Mm-hmm. There were skeletons. There were strange, mushy places in the earth that you didn't know what was made that mushiness. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like nature had a truth, mm-hmm. and that it recognized my truth and said, that's okay, and at any moment you can see something amazing and beautiful. And I got that from backyards in the Midwest of America, and it just has always stayed with me. I find that's where my spiritual strength is.
Yes, I'm glad to hear that, because not only do we have a Hoosier connection, we have an Illinois connection. When I was a little boy, right behind our house, we had about 20 acres of woods in Springfield, Illinois.
And I lived in Springfield, too. It's too funny.
That is interesting. But that's where I fell in love with the earth, just because I loved it. I loved the ponds. I loved the trees. I built tree forts. I found animals. I found dead animals. I just grew up having this fondness for it because I first fell in love with it.
Yeah. Falling in love. That's it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you started your foundation, what, 9, 10 years ago? Am I right?
Yeah, 2009.
Okay.
2009.
Yeah, and what was the prompting of that?
Well, the story of Radical Joy for Hard Times actually begins about 20 years before I founded the organization. Mm-hmm. I used to live in New York, and I wrote multimedia shows. And I did one year for IBM that was not about computers, but that they would like us to find interesting people to write about. Mm-hmm. Inspiring people, and I had discovered in the New York Library an article about a man from the Oneida Nation named David Paulus, who had developed a system of recycling steel waste. Mm. And so we went out to interview him for this program, and he told me a story about how he had gotten this grant from the National Science Foundation, very prestigious grant, because he had developed a way of recycling steel waste. And he was the first Native American to ever get this grant. And he was also not quite 40 years old, so he was feeling pretty good about himself. And he drove out to the Kaiser Steel plant in California and took some buckets out of his car to climb up this enormous, he described this enormous compacted mound of red iron oxide steel waste. And he was going to collect samples and bring them back to his lab. So he climbed to the top of this mountain, and he said to the mountain, I will conquer you. He filled his buckets with samples. He went back down to his car. And then he said he realized, you know, that's just not the way to talk to the earth, any part of the earth. So he said, Creator, show me the way to be in relation to this mountain. And he realized, he said, when I was interviewing him, I realized that the waste was not an enemy to be conquered. It was an orphan that had gotten separated from the circle of life. Hmm. And my job was to bring it back to the circle of life. And I just was so touched by that concept. It seemed to me a way of not just recycling steel waste, but of recycling the entire concept of what in nature is outcast, not liked, avoided, hated. And it just stayed with me. And I pursued for, I guess, 20 years. 20 years I tried to figure out, what do I do with this information? Mm-hmm. And I wrote some articles, some essays. I tried to lead a few programs. Found out that people don't necessarily want to pay to go to damaged places.
Yes.
And then it finally occurred to me to found a nonprofit, and you could give the information to people and then get donations from people who agreed with you and from programs.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. But it was a long, long search.
Yeah. This is really what I love about your work over the years, what I love about this specific book. It's really about honoring Earth's wounded places, not just grieving and getting mad and leaving and not going there anymore. What is your definition of a wounded place, and why do you think it's so important that we spend time with them?
Oh, great questions. Well, to me, I think that a wounded place is any place that you identify as wounded, a place that you look at and you say, that's not what I wish it was. Perhaps it's not what I remember it as and mm-hmm. was fond of. Mm-hmm. And it could be a tree in your own yard. A tree could be a wounded mm-hmm. place because insects are are infesting it and killing it.
Yeah.
It could be a place that is fallen into war. Mm-hmm. Or it could be a town like Paradise, California, that was burned down in a fire. Mm-hmm. It could be a river that was subjected to a chemical spill or a mining spill. So it could be anything where your heart is touched when you think of it. And the reason that to spend time in them, it's like thinking about, and you know, you as a hospice worker, you know this better than anyone. If you have a friend who's ill, you don't just say, oh, well, that person's ill. She can't do what she used to be. We can't go on hikes anymore. Therefore, she's not in my life anymore.
Yeah.
She doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So hopefully you would go and you would sit with your friend and ask her about her life now and pay attention to who she is. And even though you're regretting that she's not able to do what she used to do, you still love her. You still are looking for her beauty. You're still finding her individuality, even in her illness. And so that's why we spend time in these hurt places, because they are still a part of our hearts. They're still a part of our community, part of the wilderness areas we used to like to walk through. And our biography is so deeply interwoven with the places we love. So I don't think we can be whole healthy. We can't be a whole healthy planet and ignore these hurt places any more than we can be whole healthy individuals and ignore the hurt, dark places within us.
You know, listening to that answer, I was thinking about a couple of hospice patients that I've had. Many of them are elderly, and I'll look at the photos when they were beautiful or so handsome when they're in their 20s. And now, either because of cancer or some other diseases, not so beautiful, at least according to the world's terms. But when you have the eyes to see, when you have a sense of reverence in your spirit, oh, they're still beautiful, just in a different way. And it's honoring that. It's honoring that with dignity and respect. And that's exactly what you're doing regarding the earth.
Yes, exactly. Dignity and respect. And what people find, so with my organization, we invite people all over the world to go to places that they consider hurt or wounded or, or damaged or broken, and to spend time there and to make gifts of beauty for these places.
Yeah.
And it is that process of honoring, because our tendency, perhaps even especially as Americans, because we have such a, we brought up with this can do, can fix, can be anything sort of attitude. You go to a place like this and immediately your mind starts going, how can I fix this? How can this be restored?
Mm-hmm.
How can it be different?
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. You know, that's important.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're also saying is just go there and be with it and it's hurtness, it's woundedness, and see what you can discover there that's beautiful and worth noticing.
Yeah. Yeah, you talked about a group of people who went to Florida Beach after the BP oil spill, and they played music and made art from objects they found in the sand. And you said a couple came along, and the man said, are you a musical group? And one of the women said, no, we're just making a gift for a sick friend, meaning the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And the couple, they got it. When I saw that, it just brought tears to my eyes.
I know. That's one of my favorite stories.
Because we're not doing that. I mean, actually, this is the first time I've heard of someone like you, and your book documents all of this, where they are going to those places that don't naturally now draw the tourists, because those places need it the most now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the earth has given so much to us,
mm-hmm.
and all these places do. In practical ways, in psychological ways, in social ways, in spiritual ways, they've given so much to us. And so now here's our opportunity to give back.
Yeah. How do you get people to make that mindset to, you talk about recycling the mind in your book, I think,
mm-hmm.
to begin to see things differently to the point where they're getting very much involved, but in a different way now?
Well, one of the ways we do it is we have an annual event. This year, it's in fact June 22nd. It's called the Global Earth Exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called an Earth Exchange because, like I just said, it's a way of giving back. The Earth gives to us. Now we get to give back. So on this day, we invite people all over the world to to go to these hurt places in their areas and to share the stories about what the places mean to them, and to spend a little time alone walking around or sitting and really see the place as it is now, and then to make this collaborative, creative act of beauty. And so this happens once a year, and we put the slides and the stories up on our radicaljoy.org website. Mm-hmm. And the things that people do are so moving and creative. It always blows my mind and moves me so much. I mean, everything, like, there's a group called the Afghan Peace Volunteers in mm-hmm. Kabul, Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. They participate by working in their garden. Mm-hmm. People do things for mountaintop mining. They do things for clear-cut forests, for streams, for just all kinds of things, all kinds of circumstances. And what they often do that we recommend is to make a bird, which is the Radical Joy for Hard Times symbol, mm-hmm. out of materials that the place itself offers. Mm. So sticks, stones, flowers, rubbish, whatever. And the beauty of that is it's kind of like a reminder that you're giving the place new beauty out of what's already there in the old hurt. You know, so it's... So that's kind of like a little subtle message that comes across with that.
Yeah, that's awesome. I know you write, in Bali, members of a mountain village do a road cleanup. In Oregon, a group visits a clear-cut forest. In Missouri, they make a mural for a town that was damaged by floods. There are opportunities like that wherever we live, isn't there?
All over the place.
Yeah.
And you know, it's funny because every now and then somebody will email me and they say, oh, it sounds like a great idea, but there aren't any wounded places where I live. and then
say, honey,
I get
wake
on
up.
The internet and I Google for 30 seconds and I write them a note and I said, well, here are some options. You know?
Yeah.
How are the honeybees doing? Mm. How are the bats doing? Any insect infestation? Then look up at the sky. You know, how's the atmosphere?
Well, and also when I talk to some of my friends that live on both coasts of Florida, they're grieving over the fact that a lot of the places of nature being bulldozed down to create more condos,
yeah.
and where do the animals go? That's mm-hmm. another way we're doing that, supposedly in the guise of progress. There was a chapter in here that caught my eye because I've always been drawn to what many have called the holy gaze. You know, people talk about a gaze they get from their guru. People mentioned that perhaps when Jesus walked the earth, when he would look at people, there'd be that holy gaze. You have a chapter called Befriending the Gaze, and within that chapter, there was a touching story. I don't know if you remember it. It was about a couple of chimpanzees in Tanzania.
Yeah. Yeah, I found that story in a book about animal intelligence.
Uh-huh.
It's called When Elephants Weep, and which I read many, many, many years ago. And there was a scientist who was studying chimpanzees in Tanzania, and he went up to a hillside to watch the sunset, and he heard some sort of noises on two opposite sides of this hill that he was on. And up one side came a chimpanzee, and up another side came another chimpanzee. And they sort of greeted each other by leaping around and panting and doing their chimpanzee hello. And then they sat down side by side on the hillside to look at the sun. I mean, that's just such an extraordinary story.
It was touching just visualizing that.
And
then what would happen if we as human beings could model something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You quote Chogram Trungpa, one of my favorite Buddhist authors, a quote I hadn't heard before, but he said, going to a wounded place and looking directly at it, gazing at it, can actually be the first step toward rebuilding the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you're seeing it as it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the hospice work. You know, when somebody is in hospice, their family and their loved ones can't say, oh, she's going to get better. Well, maybe they try to do that, but there comes a point where you just can't convince yourself of that anymore.
Right.
And so when we go to a wounded place, we're not necessarily getting rid of that that hope or that mission or that goal. Mm-hmm. But just for the time being, we're saying, I'm just going to sit here. I'm going to see what is. I'm going to let this place get into me. Mm-hmm. It sounds, its sights, and my own responses to it as it is right now.
Yeah. You lead workshops internationally. Is there a particular wounded place that inspires your work more than others?
Well, I guess it's where I live right here in northeastern Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
Now, there's a lot of gas fracking around here, and it's not all that well-regulated,
mm-hmm.
and there's unknown factors about pollution of the air, pollution of the rivers, pollution of streams. They've even discovered that there's microbes a mile and a half down into the earth that have been living there since there were ancient seas 350 million years ago. So I feel like the earth around here is being torn up for financial gain, and that makes me sad.
Mm-hmm.
But I just feel sad whenever I see a place that's hurt. Or, you know, I know people who lived in that area where the camp fire was last year in California, and I felt terribly sad about that just for them.
You know, I think of the work of Julia Butterfly Hill, or I think of a time when I had the good fortune of talking to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and the common theme in both you and I growing up as we did, it's only when you fall in love with something that then you can't help but want to protect it.
Yeah.
So exactly. Much of this is really embedded in love, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. And you know what? That's so important, Richard, because I talk about, towards the end of my book, about fairy stories. And just to take one example, The Beauty and the Beast. The Beauty and the Beast, she doesn't fall in love with the Beast after he turns handsome. She falls in love with him. She gives back to him generosity and kindness. Then he turns handsome. So love precedes seeing something as beautiful. And what's so interesting about these events that we do with Radical Joy for Hard Times is people are always writing us after they do an earth exchange, and they say, I can't believe it. I went to this place. I went to this Superfund site because my friend thought it was a good idea, and I thought it was going to be depressing, and we went there, and we told stories, and we made beauty, and I ended up falling in love with the place.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something about this willingness to give attention and care and this simple act of beauty. Like, you don't have to be an artist. You don't have to haul in a lot of supplies.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be a spiritual guru with incense and special things. You just make beauty out of what's there. And then people, it's like something really chemically switches in people, and they fall in love with these places.
Yeah. Share how your work, you know, grieving the environment, honoring the wounds, how that is also interrelated with more traditional or broader environmental activism, where they might be protesting or fighting carbon emissions, per se, as an example.
Yeah, and all of that, like, and I reiterate, the ways that people protest
mm-hmm.
and are really important, and I'm definitely not saying that what the work I do is should replace any of that.
Mm-hmm.
Except I think a lot of times it tries to leap over our feelings.
Mm-hmm.
It tries to make us feel frightened about what's happening in the world, and goodness knows there's plenty to feel frightened about. And then the next approach is, well, it's all our fault because we drive too much and we eat too much and we spend too much, you know, we spend too much money.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like action, 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 action. But it doesn't say, how do you feel about what's happening here? And what's going on in your heart when you think about all of this? And there's sadness, you know, there's real grief and there's sorrow. And we need to be in touch with that. And there are increasing movements and books by a lot of people these days, over the last maybe 5 years or so, where they do recommend feeling our grief for the places that we love and the species of animals and plants that we love are better being lost. But some of them kind of like stop with the grief. And what I think is really important to do is recognize the living world that is important to us as alive. It's like a friend. It's
yeah.
like that sick friend.
Yeah.
And so being in a relationship to it and not just saying, I grieve, and then stopping there, but how can I cheer up this friend right now? A friend of mine who has done the Global Earth Exchange with kids, she calls her programs Cheering Up Mother Earth, which I think is beautiful.
I
it's
love
like
that.
Saying, bringing a little bit of joy into this situation.
Yes, I love that. And by finding meaning and making beauty in Earth's broken places and doing it with others, it's really inspiring community engagement, isn't it? And it's bringing people together and closer together.
It is very much so. Yeah, I did an event here in where I live in Pennsylvania, in Susquehanna County, a couple of years ago for the Susquehanna River, which a few years ago was named the most polluted river, most endangered river in America because of all the gas drilling activity. And the people that attended this event were Republicans and Democrats. They were several different religions and of no religion, you know, really diverse group of people. But what we had in common was our love for the Susquehanna River and for this rural county that we live in. And we sat on the grass and we told stories about our county and the river, and we wove a wreath out of flowers that we picked right around the site, and we put the wreath in the river. And, you know, if it weren't for our common love of where we live and of
yes.
this river, we probably wouldn't have ever got to know each other or come together.
Yes, yes. And this is the kind of movements I would love to see continue to grow in a wider and wider way, because it really touches people's hearts. It brings them together. And by the way, what are a few tools for community engagement? I mean, you talk about ceremony, a vigil, things like that.
Yeah, I think it can be very, very simple, but and people don't have to be experts in doing it. You gather together your friends, your neighbors, people from your church group, and you pick a place to go to and visit, and then you start out by just having people relate their experiences with this place. How do you remember it? I remember doing one once, and this woman said, you know, I've probably driven this way 100 times, and I've never actually stopped and sat here. And then people can just take some time to go and explore the place, you know, discover what they see, look for areas of beauty, and then they can share about that. And then it concludes with making a gift for the place. So you don't have to be any kind of expert or group leader or anything like that in order to do this. And I should also add that a lot of people who do these events just do them on their own. You don't. We always say it's an earth exchange, even if it's only you and a friend, or even if it's only you and the earth. And by doing it on your own, whenever you encounter a place that's hurt, you're just making some beauty for it and stopping and maybe talking to it. I mean, I always talk to the earth.
Yeah.
Then it's like that's how you're sort of keeping it going in your own consciousness and in your own practice.
Yeah. You know, one of my all-time favorite teachers is Leo Buscaglia, and you are the Leo Buscaglia of the earth, loving the earth.
Thanks.
And yeah, that's a huge compliment, by the way, and I think you
it
know
sure
that.
Is.
By the way, side note, I was pleased to see this book published by North Atlantic Books. I love what they're doing with activism and with their publishing company.
It's a wonderful publisher. I'm thrilled to be with them.
Yes, absolutely. The book is Radical Joy for Hard Times, Finding Meaning and Making Beauty in Earth's Broken Places. And I can't recommend this book enough to all my listeners out there across the country, here in Indianapolis as well. Trebby, give us your web address again, please.
It's radicaljoy.org.
Radicaljoy.org. It's such a joy to have you on the program again, and we'll have you back. We'll get an update on what's going on with you and with the Radical Joy movement out there.
Richard, I would love that. I really like our conversations a lot.
Well, I enjoyed that conversation with Trebby, and I so admire the work that she's doing. And you know what? Check out the website, radicaljoy.org. You might want to join her on one of these adventures. I know I might be thinking about it as well. I want to thank you for joining me today. That is our podcast. I want to thank my engineer, Thomas Gismondi, and production coordinator, Angel Richardson, for helping to make this possible. I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Dying to Live.